is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Appreciate y'all joining us here for this beautiful July Sunday. And if you're with us live, if you are so inclined, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a link to the chat room where Paul is standing athwart the quarterdeck there. So you can come and join in with Paul. And during the course of the show, if you have some topics you would like for us to talk about today, because this is our ever-popular free-for-all melee format, we have a few things that we're going to talk about. But there might be something that you regulars who join us live, you might want to chime in on. So if you'd like to do that, you can always mention it in the chat room. We'll watch it as the show goes forward. Or if you're feeling real adventurous, heck, you can call the studio if you want to. 347-308-8397. Hey, Stephen. Stephen's coming in the old chat room. So if Stephen wants to call, he can look on the show page and see the phone number as well. Besides that, being that we're no longer in the pre-show, I can still say good afternoon, my illustrious co-host. Hey. How are you doing today?
Hello. Hello, Sal, and welcome to all those who have gathered in the chat room so far. Anybody listening to us who isn't watching the exciting finale of the Italy-England Euro 2020 soccer match.
Well, I think the swordfish torpedo bombers kind of solved that forever. So that's the first thing I thought of when I saw the final. Like, hey, the Battle of Toronto. Or Taranto. Battle of Toronto, that's up in Canada, isn't it? Toronto,
yeah.
I don't know
if there are any. Yeah. I know there was a battle for Montreal. I'm not sure of the battle for Toronto.
I think John Candy made a movie about that. I'm not sure.
Canadian bacon?
Canadian. When in doubt, play in Canada. Everybody, I assume, had a pretty straightforward July 4th weekend. We seemed to get through it okay, but it was an interesting time right afterwards, coincidental and all. I guess just to kick things off, let's talk a little bit about Afghanistan. I think one of the more interesting things, we've talked about Afghanistan a lot here on the show, and I've written about it a fair bit hither and yon. And one thing that I had mentioned before is back when I was working the issue a little over a decade ago, when we were working Shape Clear Hold Build with General McKernan, and the question came up, well, what happens if it doesn't work, or we're not given enough time for it to work, which history show we didn't. And our general consensus was, well, just retreat to the nearest airhead, give our friends what they need to fight with everything else we can't pack up, blow up. And I wouldn't have thought that Kabul would be the last airhead, because little America up in Bagram, we just walked out of it. That big air base that, and I kind of want to talk about the China angle here for a second, but that was one course of action I didn't quite expect. I always thought that for a variety of reasons, Bagram would be one of the last places we went, but I guess we're going to rely on the world-renowned ability of the Turkish Armed Forces to keep Kabul Airport open up a lot for us. But besides those who really were invested in it and some talking heads, it was actually that and our general withdrawal from Afghanistan has been fairly quiet for your average American. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think, first thing is, unlike the Vietnam War, where we had draftees and all that, all this stuff has been fought by, for the most part, the exception of rotation National Guard units or maybe some reserve units in and out or individual reservists, it's been fought by volunteer forces. So the old appeals to, my son was called up from his job at the refinery and got sent off and, all that kind of has disappeared in this. And, everybody's trying to draw the only parallels I see between what's going on in the parallel and the Vietnam War, of which I was a very late participant, was that at the last minute we tried to take people who had been on our side who we knew were going to be killed or had their families killed. We allowed them to depart, get land. I don't even know if you were old enough to remember the South Vietnamese helicopters landing on ships and we're rolling them off the side. And one guy even landed, I think, some kind of small Piper Cub or something. He landed on one of the ships. Anyway, so I guess the big controversy now is going to be the interpreters and other people who, maybe government officials who were viewed as, who have already taken care of themselves by feathering their nests in Paris or other places, who are viewed as helping us, and they know that if the Taliban take complete control, that their lives are not worth the plug nickel, whether we're going to allow them to, some people talk about Guam, other places where we can stage them as they move into the U.S. I guess the good news for the and bad news for the Afghans is they can't do the boat people thing like the Vietnamese did to self-extract out of the country. And I don't know how long the wealthy who supported us are going to be able to get out of that country at any airport. You can never tell how fast things are going to crater. And the only thing I see that is going to be similar is going to be some kind of last-minute dash to try and save those who helped us. Everybody, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't a participant in this, and so I don't really have a good feel for those who served in country, whether they're, they feel like they're, I guess if I were wounded and stuff, I might feel my time was not well used. But, the other thing I see is that there's been a lot of blame pinned, with Rumsfeld's death, there's been a lot of pointing fingers at some of the things that he didn't do to protect our troops from IEDs and other things. So there's always a lingering bitterness to those in charge. And it's not the bitterness that I see from Vietnam veterans who've read, McMaster's or the Pentagon Papers or some of these other books that actually show what a absolute incomprehensible way we got involved in that war and stayed involved compared to what we were trying to do in this war. And I'm well known for being one of those punitive expedition guys. I thought we did the right thing at first. We sent a small group of people. We thump really hard on the bad actors, and then we should have just gotten out at that point. But, the other heads come in, we're going to make it safe for women and the vote and, all the things that the Taliban are against, we're going to try and impose on these people nicely because we're good people. But if we're going to roll out, that means that all that stuff is going to put a lot of people in danger.
Yeah. At the beginning in 2001, I was in Bahrain. That was a general feeling when we were kicking things off through the first few months after 9/11. We all thought we were going in for a punitive expedition, again, waiting for higher direction and guidance. And the things that were decided that, quote, had to be done, must be done. That was the international community. That was politicians. That was think tanks. Those were various academic theories. You can go back to the Bonn Accords if you're looking for original sin I was looking back over some of the stuff from 02, 03, 04 last week, and you can just see the glacial mission creep as additional higher direction and guidance. I thought what was interesting, though, as I kind of went through that timeline, I'm putting together a little slideshow. I'm going to turn into a video, put up on YouTube just to make myself feel better about every ISAF change of command. So a lot of people forget that it was a NATO operation more than it was an American operation for a long time, though we did most of the lifting. Early on in the conflict, some of the nations that were pretty substantial troop-contributing nations, these were maneuver forces that actually were holding and securing territory, relatively caveat-free. People forget the Canadians and the Dutch. And the Canadians and the Dutch decided in 2007 that 5 to 6 years was enough. They saw and did what we are now doing. Other nations did similar things. Other ones took out a significant number of forces and just put a flag up there later. So I don't think there's any shame for seeing now what the Dutch and the Canadians saw back then, that it wasn't worth the effort and blood to do that. But there was also, and it might be related to having a parliamentary form of government, vice our form of government, but there's also the consent of the governed going on here. And I understand the arguments, and I can make them if you really want to, about why we should be there, the death count for us is, unless you're one of the families, small. The financial investment, though in the aggregate, is significant, but yearly, not so much. I understand those arguments. However, the consent of the governed. President Obama was elected twice. President Trump was elected once. President Biden was elected once. All three of those individuals in those four presidential elections, they were won by candidates who either overtly or hinted at the desire to end the conflict in Afghanistan by leaving. At least for me, famously, President Obama in December of 2009 said, we're getting out the summer of 2011. And the international community, the think tanks, the various academia theories and their friends in the Obama administration convinced him not to do that, along with the military, for a variety of reasons, some of which I can make and defend, even though I may not agree with them. I can't argue both sides of this, which is convenient, I guess. President Trump, that's all he talked about, was getting out of conflicts. And President Biden, he was all about getting out of Afghanistan. So if people wanted to make the argument to stay in Afghanistan, they first of all, since December of 2009, owed it to the American people to sell that, which they didn't. It was people assumed we would stay there because all the smartest people in the room say we had to be. And you would also have to have that reflected in the electoral performance for those wanting to be commander-in-chief. So people could argue and make good arguments, I think, for staying in Afghanistan. But if you're a representative republic, what does the will of the people? There is no will of the people for us to occupy Afghanistan ad nauseum, which when you talk to or you try to make the argument for staying there, if you get the follow-on question, okay, well, how long are we going to be there? Most of the young Taliban soldiers running around right now were born after we moved in 2001. So, yeah, how much longer? Good question.
Well, it reminds me of what was the Weinberger Doctrine, which became the Powell Doctrine. You know, don't go into war unless you know what you want the end result to look like. And it's, you know, the authorization of the use of military force tool, which has a use, I guess, you know, it's, but stops us from declaring war, or allows us not to declare war on people while we're going to war on people. You know, I saw some the other day that some governors are looking at not allowing National Guard units to go to war unless there is a declaration of war instead of just one of these authorization of the use of military forces. I don't know if that's right or not. I don't know if that's a, you know, a great idea. I just know that if you have a goal, you know, and once you've achieved that goal, if the goal is to destroy as much of Al-Qaeda as we could and cripple them so they couldn't do another 9/11, you know, and I don't understand why the goal suddenly, as you said, morphs into all these nice-to-have projects that will make people love us, even though they're contrary to a lot of the social structure and mores of the people who live in that country. You can't, you know, when are we going to learn not to try and impose our idea of good things onto people who have their own ideas of good things? You know, you can't, it's very hard to bomb people or blast people into submission to ideas that their religion, that their culture reject. And I find that, you know, that of all the people we sent over there, we did send teams of people who were supposed to understand or study the Afghan culture and tell us what we could do right or wrong. But I don't know how many of those people actually, you know, and I have questions about a lot of the reporting, both internal to the military and externally, about what was really going on and who, you know, what the plan was to deal with the various contingencies in a country like, well, if you even call it a country, in a place like Afghanistan.
Afghans will do things on Afghan time and.
Well, you're cutting in and out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're there. Okay.
Yeah, we're having some storms. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that Osama bin Laden was right. He didn't think we'd last in a conflict. Maybe 20 years is maybe it's our longest war. So, I guess that is kind of the upper limit now. But and he learned the lesson from Ho Chi Minh. You know, you guys are going to be gone someday, and we're still going to be here. So basically, that's what the Afghans, the Taliban, wait us out. And so adios, guys.
Yeah, that's one thing. There's a couple of excitable people that are talking about, when the U.S. leaves, China's going to come in, and China has great plans to do with Afghanistan. I just say two things. One, if after we go, if China goes into Afghanistan and makes it a place full of shiny, happy people and they fix everything, well, good for them and good for Afghanistan. Maybe we should sit down with our old Soviet counterparts and say, what do we screw up that the Chinese got right? I don't think that's going to be the case. Also, if China goes in Afghanistan, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. You've been breaking up kind of badly there, so maybe there was a bit of thunder that rolled through your house.
Yeah, this is summertime in the tropics. We're having our regular afternoon storms. Hopefully it'll be intermittent. I don't know how much of my little dialogue about China, but if China moves in after we do, they're welcome to it. Good luck to them. But I think we'll be okay without having why a North American country needs a Central Asian bastion, not to be confused with Bastion and RC South, out of Bagram Airfield to counter a nation that has one-fifth of the world's population. I don't buy it. We had 2 decades to get it right. We didn't. The American people don't want us to keep trying. So that's kind of the way it should go. And if something happens bad because of it, it probably would have happened anyway.
Yeah, you know, just looking at it, we've talked about this so many times in the past. I mean, the logistics problem of Afghanistan. I mean, we're not going to leave. Obviously, we're leaving a bunch of gear there because we can't get it out. And, you know, we're not in a friendly neighborhood. Pakistan is as much responsible for the reason we're leaving as any other country. And on the other side, there's Iran. I mean, it's not like that's the neighborhood we really want to play in anyway. But the logistics issue, you know, I guess we're going to leave a small force there to defend the embassy. And we don't even have an ambassador right now, so that'll be interesting. And I hope there's some contingency plan to get whoever we do leave behind out in a great big rush, because I just don't like the logistics of being there. But, you know, I guess the good news is that for those of us who are punitive expedition kind of guys, we are going to get out. We don't have to wrestle with issues of Afghanistan anymore. We can go back to wrestling with issues in Iraq and Syria and a myriad of other places, Somalia and all those that big country that we're just talking about that sits on the side of the western side to us of the Pacific Ocean.
Hey, Paul, in the chat room was interested in a discussion about SWO retention. I'm a little bit detached from the active duty force, but you know, one thing that I will, which is interesting, is he's rather active on Twitter in both his official and his private account. PERS 4, the head Navy detailer, is a Rear Admiral Derek Trinke. I think I pronounced that correctly. If not, sorry about that, Derek. But on his personal account, which is @DATRNQ, Delta Alpha Tango Romeo November Quebec. Back on June 8, he had a thread in a response to a Navy Times article on why can't the Navy keep its surface warfare officers. And I actually had a back-and-forth exchange with him, which I give him credit to. He will engage you on Twitter in a constructive way. And his thread dated on the 8th, I think he covers some pretty good responses about SWO retention. And I kind of covered this in my exchange with him. A lot of the points that he makes, I heard as a midshipman. There is a problem with SWO retention. SWO culture, we've talked about here over and over. And in his position, he's got to be very limited for what he can say. But my take is if we have an established problem, and we know we do, and we aren't doing significant things to change career paths and some of those requirements, system that gives very limited flexibility for people who are different, in a variety of ways, without putting themselves in significant danger. Anyway, if we continue with the career path that we've had since I've been a midshipman with its rewards and incentives and priorities, we're not going to get a different result. And I can appreciate his enthusiasm in defending the system. But it's kind of wedded to things we've talked about here before, joint requirements. But really, we set our own requirements. Who we select for command and why sends a demand signal down to career-minded people, making a conscious decision to have 8 to 9 month deployments be the normal and 11-month deployments not to be unusual, and to pat ourselves on the back about how efficient our manning is on our ships to the point that 100-hour weeks are normal. And I'm sorry, I don't buy it. Saying that we're going to continue to do the same thing, but this time we're going to get different results, I don't think you're going to address slow retention until you address many of those latent causes that were brought up after the collisions of the Fitzgerald and the McCain. And though it was part of it, the solution is not more simulators. It's a people issue and it's a priority issue. But if people are on Twitter and they haven't looked at that from the ape life, if you're interested about slow retention or at least what the head detailer view is, I would recommend that thread to you. And I think he very much heartfelt believes in what he's saying. And he's not incorrect in his career advice on that thread. I think is spot on because that is what the demand signal is. I think it's the wrong demand signal. But if you are that J.O. in the room who has a J.G. has already planned out what his 06 command is going to be down the road, then yeah, follow that advice. But anyway, interesting exchange.
Yeah, I think it was a congressional research study. I can't find it right now. I did download it someplace that talked about the different possibilities for what SWOs could do. And you know, they looked at different models. They looked at the Royal Navy model, where you have basically guys who are ship drivers. Yeah. They're the ones who can qualify command. You got guys who are chief engineers, sort of like Scotty in Star Trek. They don't do anything but engineering stuff. You got, I guess, weapons guys or something. That all they do is deal with the weapons stuff. Anyway, the you know, and they looked at some other approaches, and the U.S. Navy approach as a SWO, the U.S. Navy approach has been to make you a generalist so that you would know something about all the components of a ship, so that when you did make CO, which was the goal of all surface warfare officers, to be CO of a ship, that you would be able to converse with the people who work for you intelligently about what it is that, you know, they have the combat systems, the combat operations, the ship driving, the engineering, all that stuff, so that you would have a good handle on all this stuff. You know, that's an approach, and it's not a bad approach if you have enough ships. And this is where I see the big failing in the SWO community. And this is, you know, if your goal is to make people COs, you've got to have enough ships to make them COs and let them be COs for the period of time that they can enjoy being a CO. So my normal assumption was when I got a new job in the Navy or even outside the Navy, it takes you a few months to get up to speed on your job. And it takes you, and then you can enjoy that job after, you know, maybe it's 3, maybe it's 6 months when you really finally get into the right boots you should be wearing. And about the time you're doing that on the surface Navy, you're rotating out again because it's like an 18-month tour, a 2-year tour. You know, that we need, this is another argument for more ships. The reason we had 8, 9, 10, 11-month deployments is we didn't have enough ships. We don't have enough ships. So and then you end up with a further frustration because we don't have enough ships. We're putting a lot of young ensigns on these ships, more ensigns we really need, which means you have young junior officers who want to be SWOs who don't have real jobs. You know, they're going to qualify as officer of the deck, maybe, but they don't, you know, they're not getting the real flavor of what it's like to be able to run a boat crew, run all the, I mean, maybe that works for some of them, but, you know, you look at the way the Coast Guard brings up their junior officers, they don't, you know, they give them boats. They let them go out and maybe it's not a huge boat, but you get an ensign or a JG out and he's the boss of that particular craft or ship or whatever. And the pitch I always make is we need more ships. We need more small ships. We need to give these JOs a chance to go out and learn how to be a commanding officer. And the advantage of that is that once you've been CO, you You get a chance to learn how to, you know why the other jobs on a ship are important. So you can go from being CEO of a small ship into being a department head on a much bigger ship. It's going to, you know, that should be seamless. We do that with the guys that we send off to aircraft carriers to be CEOs. We don't just turn them loose on the aircraft carrier right after they get out of whatever nuke power school. We usually send them off to be CEO of a large deck amphib or something so they can get a feel for what it's like being CEO of a ship. And we just need to do that with our young officers, and we need a lot more ships. And they don't have to be expensive ships, and they can be, we just need to get, we need to be sensible about how we're going to do this. And I think SWO retention would be a lot better if people could see that instead of that, I'm going to be a CEO someday, and it's going to be as a commander after I've got, 20 years in the Navy, and I get to be a CEO of a ship for, I don't know, an hour and a half or something. It's got to be more than that. The best CEOs I had had been CEOs of other ships. You know, a guy, CEO I had on a destroyer had been a minesweeper CEO. A CEO I had on a auxiliary had been CEO of a couple of submarines. I mean, of course, they were diesel boats, but, the whole point is that they had CO experience. They were much calmer, much better. We didn't have the only screamers I ever worked for were guys who had, this was their first command, and that they really, it just didn't work out for them the way it should have, because they didn't have the experience necessary to really know what they were doing. I don't think my SWO dialogue. And Stephen, you're right. The Mark VI patrol boats, we should have more of those. Let the young officer learn how to command something. And it's a shame we don't have that. I think Sal is still suffering from some magnetic spectrum interference. Do look at that at Admiral Trink's Twitter feed. It's really worth looking at. He is a straight shooter. One of the other things we were going to talk about. Can I hear you now? No, Sal, I can't hear you. Well, okay,
that's
I got you.
Why I need to have a great.
Every time we get reviewed on the websites, tell us what, if only they had better sound.
I can hear you fine. Can you hear me?
Got you now, yeah. If only they had better sound on Midrats. I guess one of the other things we should be talking about, I don't know where Sal's going to come in on this, but there's a lot of controversy about whether or not we should decommission these older cruisers. And there's one of the controversies is that some people are saying the reason that we're having so much trouble with them is we didn't do a good job maintaining them when we all along. And I guess
nature
some of the issues
cooperates.
Involved...
The last few years, our audio has gotten a lot better. That's okay, though.
Are you there? Anyway, if you're going to keep ships for longer than they're anticipated. I don't know. There's a pretty good article in the USNI News about the cruiser.
Well, I seem to be hearing you just fine, so I'll assume I'm coming through okay.
I can hear you now. So, anyway, there's a good article on USNI News about the Navy outlining planning execution failures in
either
cruise.
Y'all lost me or I've lost. Oh, beautiful. It's significant.
That is which is significant.
An old phrase about if I knew I was going to embarrass myself. Yeah.
Yeah.
I, I don't know what's coming through or what's not. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've got lightning bolts going off all around me. So.
Yeah, well, we need to get you a Faraday cage. Well, then you probably wouldn't be able to do anything out of a Faraday cage.
Run me through the degaussing ranger or something. But if you remember what happened to the spruances, and this is just a spruance hole, it's impressive that they've lasted this long, because we're looking at in 22, they want to retire the San Jacinto, the Lake Champlain, the Monterey, the Hawaii City, the Anzio, the Vela Gulf, the Port Royal, and the Fort. So that's everything from 27 to, what's my math, 33 years old. If you remember, a message went out, I want to say it was part of this in response to a shipbuilding plan in 2012, 2013, sometime during the Obama administration, talking about how we were going to have our destroyers last 45 years and our cruisers last 35 years, et cetera, and so forth. It's not happening. And this all derives from where this problem is. And I know that in Congress, Representatives Gallagher and Luria have been pushing this. Is the great thing the cruisers bring when they get underway are all the BLS cells. And if you take the big threat from China, you don't have time to divest now and build later. Because we don't have anything because of the failure of CGX. And we're slow rolling the large service combatant for reasons maybe these people can explain better than me. It makes knowing what we were able to do in the time of slide rules and drafting paper compared to what we do now is amazing. But they make a good point, but physics and maintenance have laws of their own. You may have a ship that on the books is commissioned, but how mission capable is it really? And that's why they want to decommission them. On that list as well that that went out on the 2nd of July, they also, we can drag LCS and beat it up a little bit, decommissioning the USS Little Rock next year, commissioned in 2017, and the Detroit also being decommissioned in 2016. They're getting rid of the odds pretty fast. The only even going is the Coronado LCS-4. It's an interesting list. It's also very humbling when you look at that list and bounce it off of how many ships we're building. And going back to what you talked about in the previous point is – PCs 1, 2, 5, 7, and 10 are all being decommissioned, but they're going to foreign military sales. We could get more years out of them, but we're not going to. That's a little infuriating. Mark, you there?
Yeah, we did that with the Gearing-class destroyers. A lot of them ended up in the hands of the Taiwan Navy, and they lasted another 10-15 years, and while they built up more modern ships, but they're looking at when your budget is so tight that you can't spend $5 billion to restore 7 ships over a period that would keep these ships around till you had some kind of replacement, then there you need to go screaming to Congress and say, we can't go on like this, and if you guys can't come up with the money, somebody's got it. Somebody, I said this last time, somebody's got to throw their hat down and go, I quit. If you guys won't fund the Navy that we all know we need, then you go find somebody else to run this thing, because this is ridiculous. And you hit it on the head, and Paul mentioned it in the chat room, we dumped those FFGs too fast that we had. We, you know, and I'll never forget seeing the wooden substitute for the one-armed bandit in the front of that FFG. It made no sense at all. But and the Spruances got rid of them too.
It was kind of sad. And I know the SM-1 was, quote, obsolete, but you know what? It in the anti-surface mode, that thing was pretty damn effective. And it actually has combat experience and et cetera and so forth. But I also like what the Australians did with theirs, which we could have made more economical if we went in with them when they upgraded and put some Mark 41 VLS cells right forward of the Mark 13 one-armed bandit. But, you know, that's the past that never was, so to speak. And, you know, what can you do? The screaming to Congress, you know, part of that, most people, I think, read towards the end of the week, the Indo-PACOM J2, Rear Admiral Studman, or Studman, if he was an aviator, he pulled out a really nice MacArthur quote. But I know, at least for the regulars here at Midrats, and for you and me that have been hollering about this since we started the podcast, he quoted General MacArthur, said, to explain the challenge, we'll quote here, quote, to explain the challenge of ensuring combat readiness, Admiral Studman recalled a quote by General MacArthur, quote, a history of failure in war can almost always be summed up in two words, too late. He stressed that it is vital that the U.S. defense capability remain ready for a very bad day. To achieve this mission and ensure resiliency, intelligence must be provided in the correct places so the proper action can be taken, unquote. we aren't really talking or singing from the same hymnal in a lot of ways. Is there are a lot of people who are very much focused on China, and there are, I would argue, the people who have access to more levels of power, levers of power, are more interested in making sure that the program runs and the experimental things go just like it was 2004, 2011. You know, all those points where we were comfortable at being able to think in theories. But there's a very real threat west of Wake, and I think the Indo-PACOM J2 knows this better than anybody who's listening here. You know, I mentioned a couple of people in Congress. There's maybe one or two in the Senate as well. But you know it, and I know it, and you know, Paul and Stephen and Brian and Jerry and a bunch of other folks, they know it too. But to get the general beast moving, I don't think anybody's been sufficiently shocked yet. Hopefully it won't be us, but in the likely event that the persuasive arguments don't succeed in getting us moving, it may take China coming out on the world stage and scaring the bejesus out of people. I hope that's not it. But I think we need more people bringing up issues like Indo-PACOM J2. We need to move the decimal point to the right in the Congress and the Senate for people to come up and make that conversation. But they're going to have to do it by themselves. I'm not saying it's too little too late. I do think we have time, but we've lost our wiggle room, so to speak. And this large group of decommissionings, which makes sense from a financial point of view, until we start building things, the hour of danger gets closer, vice further away.
Yeah, Admiral Studman, I guess, said it's danger on all fronts. the idea that it's only Taiwan scenario and many versus many other areas where the Chinese are being highly assertive, coercive, is a failure to understand complexity because it's not that simple. You know, we see China, they've been involved with everybody recently. They got gray zone stuff going on with Taiwan. They got gray zone stuff going on with Japan. They're using economic coercion against Australia, New Zealand. They got things going on with Malaysia, South Korea, India, Vietnam. You know, they're just they're walking right up to the edge, and then they don't back off. They just push differently, and it's a mistake to think that the first thing we're going to see, as the Admiral said, is to worry about this invasion across the Taiwan Strait. They're not. That may not be even in their thought process if they can get what they want through all these other thank you, Paul. Yeah, I forgot to mention the Philippines, and the Philippines leadership leaves a little bit to be desired sometimes when they're talking about the Chinese. But anyway, we just can't let this threat to which Russia's doing too, to the world order that was established that they reject because it doesn't comply with their view, and in the Chinese case, that they're the middle kingdom and everybody should kowtow to them. And the Russian point of view is that, yeah, we're really an important country and nobody's acknowledging that. Well, you know, so you get the kind of actions you get with Putin, who wants to restore the former Soviet Union, if not in name, certainly in the fear that it strikes in the rest of mankind.
Yeah, you also, for both the Chinese and the Russians, it's not just so much their intentions, but their capabilities. Russia talks big, and she does have a lot of legacy systems, and she does spend a lot as a percentage of her GDP, so she looks like she's significantly stronger. But when you look at the wealth she has to work with, her GDP is the equivalent of Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg combined. She's not an economic powerhouse, but she does spend a lot on her national defense. And like the Chinese, she has her finger all over the place. When they, you know, they're feeling all over the place, when they see a thin part in the international system, they poke their finger. See, they can get their finger through it. The Chinese not only have more capability, they're also talking pretty big. But they both have that human desire to recapture something. I don't think the Russians had the ability really to do much in that area, but the Chinese do. And I like that comment you said about it might be a mistake thinking too much about Taiwan. And I think you're right, because a lot of the people who are looking at the Chinese fleet, they are looking about a Taiwanese scenario. You know, what if they're not building for that. They're building for something else. Need to keep an eye on that. Look at the capabilities. When you build big ships, that's big water. Big water is not the Taiwan Straits. So the Chinese have a plan. It's just trying to figure out what it is. Right now it looks to be poking their little fingers all over the place, looking for weak spots in the wall.
Well, what's their? I mean, if you're looking at China and you go, well, what's the big weakness? I don't think this is any secret to anybody. I mean, they're dependent on access to oil and other products coming in, so that they have this long logistics sea lane issue. So their sea lines of commerce are their weak place. And what kind of navy do you build to protect that? Well, you build a big navy that can go to blue water and take over things like the Strait of Malacca and protect that their access to that, or the passage through the Andaman Islands off India, and the access to the oil fields of the Middle East. I mean, you know, I don't think it takes rocket science to see what they're doing in terms of what they perceive the threat to be to their weakest link, which is access to the raw materials they need to have an economy at all. Because they, whatever you say about China, most of it is exhausted physically. They don't have, and they don't, you know, they don't. They have some oil, I guess, but it's not like they're so. They're not dependent on other countries. I mean, that is their weakness, same weakness the Japanese had in World War II, and we're seeing kind of the same thought process. If we build this Belt and Road thing and build this large navy, then we've got our greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, and we'll be back, as I said, to be in the Middle Kingdom, and everything will be hunky-dunky.
Yeah, as their economy grows, as you would expect, their consumer sector, their people are going to want more, and they don't have domestically the ability to do that, much less feed them well. And as the Chinese, for all 5,000 years of their history, they're always focused on internal control more than anything else. They want to make sure that is uninterrupted access to the fuel, the food, and everything else. And, you know, from their perspective, rightfully, they probably figure they've been pretty lucky. But if they ever find themselves in a little bit of a crunch, they want to make sure that they aren't easily subjected to a type of embargo that other of their friends, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, et cetera, have been subjected to. They've taken those lessons, and I think they've taken it pretty well. And if I was Chinese, I would do the same thing. You know, another smart thing they're doing is while we're, you know, using SpaceX and other private contractors to send up enough metric capable baling wire and duct tape to keep the International Space Station together, Chinese are building their own. That will be interesting to see the things that they're going to do. Well, we won't see what they're doing up there because it's their own. That's one thing we've been very limited to with the International Space Station. It wasn't Reagan's initial vision of just being an American one. There's a lot of things that would be good from a national security point of view to have that space to do in orbit, but you can't in an international environment. But the Chinese, when they build their space station, that will be interesting to watch because they know that will further signify to the world their great power status when they have a premier station that they can do things to their own national interest up there. They've also shown when it comes to biology and radiology and a few other areas, they don't have the same safety and ethical concerns that Western nations have. So they may be doing some very interesting things up there. We just won't know.
Well, I was chilled enough to read that they were looking at almost like genetically engineered. This is what I'm thinking. Certainly has been a stuff of science fiction where they're studying the genetics of non-Chinese people. And I think there, you know, if I were a science fiction writer, and which I'm not, but if I would think, well, gosh, what are they doing that for? And I think, well, because what if you could create a weapon that would only affect people with certain genetic sequences? You know, and I think we've seen that in some science fiction books in the past, but, you know, that's just frightening that they're actually, it looks to me like they're actually pursuing that end. And, you know, then I've also read, and I don't know how much of this is just more scaremongering, but, you know, that they're doing something to enhance some of their soldiers. It sounds like something out of the Marvel comic book world, you know, so where they can genetically enhance people. So, and as you say, their moral code is a lot different than the ones that we in the West have had. Are you still there, Sal? Well, I don't know where Sal went this time. I think I hear a rumble. No, I can't hear you. You sound like a bad Tim Conway sketch doing the elephant skit. So, snork, snork, snork. Well, it's good you can hear me. I'm just going to keep making fun of you. I think what the best thing to do here, Sal, is we need to, because you're...
I wanted to, before the hour got done, one thing I wanted to tap into your legal mind for a bit. One of the things I went, about is the IG is not complete on the Bonhomme-Richard fire that took place a year ago. They haven't disclosed if anybody is going to be held accountable or an investigation or something like that. But if we were going to take somebody to court-martial or take an organization or individuals to criminal court, scrapping the Bonhomme-Richard, wouldn't that be a little bit of an issue if we want to hold somebody accountable? Because are we scrapping the evidence? I never really thought of it that way, but I'm just curious from your take, if we did decide to go high order on accountability, if that's needed, have we precluded that by scrapping the evidence?
I think whatever evidence that they would need to prosecute somebody, they must already have. And it's probably been preserved enough to prosecute if they have to. And for those of you who didn't know, Italy has won the Euro football thing on penalty kicks.
Yeah. Oh, penalty kicks. That's the worst.
I hate, well, I'm a lot of my kids played soccer and I really hate penalty kicks.
Well, at least I was going to make a comment about baseball, but that's just too mean. I don't think it's the soccer equivalent of putting somebody on second base. But that's okay. That's all right. But I don't know how long until we find out whether anybody's going to be held accountable or really what the cause was of the fire of the Bonhomme-Richard, because the investigation is still going on. A year later, that's a long time.
Well, yeah, but, you know, in the great scheme of things, a lot of times an investigation will take that long depending on what evidence they have. And they may have a suspect in mind and or maybe a couple of suspects in mind, and they're trying to see if they can work them somehow so that one will, you know, one or more of them will rat out another one or whatever. You know, I mean, there's so many things we don't know that it's just speculation, but... Isn't it fun to speculate?
It is. It is. Well, the one big speculation that's very much a 2021 that I can argue 60% on one side, 40% the other. But there's been a couple of rumblings that once the vaccine is approved, one of the vaccines, at least, is going to be approved, that they will make it mandatory in the military probably in September of this year. That's, you know, been one of the after effects of COVID is the anti-vaccine crowd has been bumped up by a factor of who knows how much. But that's going to be the JAG Full Employment Act there if they make it mandatory, because the national vaccines hesitancy is going to be reflected. I took every day I worked in flu and flu one, but I have to be what the, I'm sure BuMed is already doing this, but the vaccination rate that exists right now by unit and by community to see how much of an impact that would be. We should see how that works out if that September timeline plays out.
Yeah. Were you on active duty when the anthrax vaccines were out?
Did the storm get...
Yeah, I got you a little bit. Were you on active duty when the anthrax vaccines...
I got all of them.
Yeah.
Until they quit.
Yeah, well, that's... I think that some of the... I'm not sure how much... I mean, the whole anti-vaccine thing just drives me nuts anyway, but that's... You know, that's the way it goes. We'll see how that works out.
We're coming up near the end of the hour, and I guess we can end on a COVID note and the JAG Full Employment Act, but the anthrax, that bastard hurt. The COVID vaccines they didn't hurt. I do know 106. Senior 06, who refused to take it, had to have a one-on-one conversation with a two-star admiral. I don't know whether it would be elevated that much, but we'll have stuff like that to work about.
Yeah, I think if, you know, some of the people I talk to, they're just concerned that we don't know the long-term impact of this, especially on kids, which so they haven't really been giving it to kids yet, although they're expecting to get that out pretty soon. But, you know, I say the same thing, though, about a lot of other vaccines I took a polio vaccine back in the early days, and, you know, there are all kinds of things like that. But it's just the way it goes. I think we better go before your thunderstorms really just completely.
I do have another wave coming in.
Do you? Yeah. Well, you might want to go back. You might want to go back and edit out some dead air on this one. it's been interesting.
I'll do a little bit of, see if I can do some post production, but hopefully next week we won't have that problem. We think we have a guest lined up, but as always, it's been a great hour. And Paul and Stephen and everybody else in the chat room, thank you for joining us.
Yes, indeed.
And until next time, have a storm-free Navy Day. Cheers.
Marry me and so leave the strand and Piccadilly.